Good evening, everyone. My name is Clara, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clara. And I'm great. We love you, Clara. Lots and lots and lots.
I love you too. Thank you for asking me to come this weekend. I'd like to thank Jesse and Cassidy for picking me up at the airport today, and it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for that I'm grateful. I love the enthusiasm and the excitement here, and I love Canada. I've had the privilege over the years to go to all parts of Canada, and by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sober 31 years this year. Miracle, miracle. We tell our story in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a roaring winette. And in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, and more about alcoholism, it describes the insane things that we sometimes continue to do to keep from doing step one, two, and three. And in that list of insanities, one of them says we switch to natural wines. Man, I had switched to Ripple. Now, that's not one of your natural wines. As a matter of fact, I don't think a single grape was ever near that stuff, you know? I don't know what they put in it, but I want to tell you, by that time, I was literally doing a dance with death. And I come from the jazz world, Boston, New York, and Harlem, and in those days, and I know what the dance of death was about, and I know when the music stopped, and I couldn't stop drinking, and the madness began. I actually was born in Atlanta, Georgia, wonderful family. My father was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian of the Cherokee Nation, and he moved from Georgia to Alabama and around that area at that time. He lived on that reservation actually until he was probably about 24, 25 years old, and had seven kids. They moved to Atlanta, and I was born in Atlanta at Grady Hospital. And I grew up, my father was an artist, an entrepreneur, and a wonderful man. I absolutely adored my father. I won an art scholarship from Booker T. Washington High School in Atlanta that took me to Boston. I was educated at the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. And that's where when I moved from Atlanta, I can remember sitting on a segregated train in those days out of Georgia, giving up. giving Atlanta all of it. And I really believe I'm one of the one that was born restless, irritable, and discontented right out of the chute, man. You know, I could have had a little drinky poo. Probably in the first grade, just to get me to the second grade. <You know? laughs> And I grew up, when I grew up in Georgia, in the entire South, below what they call the Mason-Dixon line, there was no alcohol. I didn't know alcohol existed on the planet Earth, and it was the Bible Belt, the entire South, and there were no package stores, and I just didn't know it existed. And when I went to Boston, for the first time, I was exposed to a whole new world. I lived in the South, and doing the racism and all the things that I went through growing up there, and it was a whole new life. I always loved music. And I grew up with a stepmother who never allowed me to do things that girls were doing, that always girls growing up liked to do. You know, I'd never had a date, I couldn't wear makeup, it was a very religious family, not on my father. My father did his rituals out and the great earth in the backyard. He never went to church, and I had a lot of feelings of missed messages growing up. That had nothing to do with my alcoholism, but this is just the way it was when I was growing up. So when I got to Boston, you know, I'd always wanted to go to be in the theater, and when I was in high school, I wasn't allowed to do that because she termed that as the devil's work. Well, I walk into that art school, and I look around, and I got to tell you something. Even then, that feeling of excitement, that feeling of living on the edge was always there. I'd always loved music. I was never allowed to listen to jazz music or anything growing up because it was not part of our religion. But I walked into that school, I looked around, and I had that feeling of excitement, that feeling of, as I said, living on the edge. I was later to learn, you know, if you weren't living on the edge, you were taking up too much space in the world, you know. So I started going to the movies. I was 19 years old, I'd never been to a movie. And I loved what they did up there on that screen. And I'd sit there and I'd just day in, all day, just listen, you know, and look at the movies over and over and over again. And I loved that music so much that I, you know, I would play records and over again. And this was a great time in the USA because jazz was the medium in that day, at that time. One night, I was walking down the street with a friend, and I had never been in a bar, had no idea what was going on in there, and we passed this bar, and these people walked out, and I heard this music. And I said to my friend who was a student, I said, let's just go in there and see what they're doing. And we walk into this club, and I should never forget the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze, and down at the end of the bar was this rather portly lady, and she's singing the blues, and my heart started pounding, and you know, and we sat on the stool, and the bartender said, what are you going to have to drink? And I had no idea. But I remember in the movies, they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip slick cool act. I leaned on that bar and I looked in his eyes and I said, we'll have a martini, honey. I said, and make it dry. I had no idea what a dry martini was. But he turned around, he put these two lovely stem glasses up there and he evened it out. It looked like lemonade. Now, it's hot in the South, and we drank a lot of lemonade down there. And I looked at that, and I didn't know you're supposed to sip drinks. Man, I picked it up, looked out in the bar, I opened my mouth, I dumped it. Pig from the gate. But I loved the way it made me feel. As I said, I never had a date. There was a little dance floor out there, and I walk out there with the empty glass and stand watching these couples dance. And that night, you know, I got myself some new friends. The Big Book, I call them colorful, but the Big Book calls them loyal companions. I hooked up right away with the pimps, the madams, and the bad boys. And here was I hadn't even had a date yet, you know, and I'm out there, and that's the way it started. And I gotta tell you, for the next 10 years, a lot happened in that time because I started hanging in those clubs at this time, and I'll date myself because it was a number of years ago. And I started hanging in those clubs, and I got very friendly with the late, and run around with the late, great Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong. I used to hang out with Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis. There was Dinah Washington, greatest blues singer. And you could just go in. In those days, the clubs in Boston were just next door to each other. And then we'd go over to New York and hang out in Harlem. And I absolutely loved it. I got out of that school, met a very nice young man on the bar who was... came from a very nice family in Boston. He didn't know much about drinking either, so we learned to drink together. We learned to do a lot of things together. And We got out in the streets, man. I want to tell you something. I still love jazz music. I listen to it every day in my car. And but the singer that I love today is she's great, is Randy Crawford. And she sings a song about street life. And I'll pass it on to you because the lyrics really belonged to me the first time I heard the song. It said, if you are young, don't get old in the streets. Because the cold's going to hit you in the back and you're going to nickel and dime your life away. And you look back one day, it was all a masquerade. And I remember when I was out there having all that fun and living the life, and I don't regret it because I want to tell you, at the time when it worked, alcohol worked for me. In the big book in page 21, when it talks about what the real alcoholic is, and you know, I drank for years and was not in trouble. Excuse me. I drank for years and was not in trouble, and it was like magic for a long, and then it stopped working. In that marriage, we had a little son. My husband worked for his family in their business, and he came from a really nice Boston family. And we had a little son, and I started to pass him off on the grandparents to raise. There's a little part in the big book that talks about the type of alcoholic I was at the time. When it says selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our troubles. And it goes on in that book to say we're driven people. And we're driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. I mean, and that nailed me because that's just where it was. Because this was a time when I could remember, you know, my drinking stopped from the respectable hour, which was like 5 o'clock. That's cocktail hour back east. And, you know, I'm getting down to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, then long lunches, and then, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, and it's getting bad, and I'm just hanging in those clubs. And, you know, he traveled a lot in his family's business, and I used to still hang on the clubs, and I should never forget. One afternoon, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm sitting there, and Billie Holiday walked in, and she sat on the bar, and we were talking, we were chatting. And I always had this imaginary man in my mind, because for me, I have an addictive personality. One is not enough after a while. While the cat is away, the mice plays, and this man, if you're in those clubs long enough, you know, they come and they just show up. And she and I were talking, and this guy walked up. I'm going to describe him. He had a black hat turned down all the way around. He had a top coat over his shoulder. This dude was so cool, he couldn't even get his arms through the sleeves. He reached his hand in his pocket. He pulled out a roll of money. Oh, I love money. And he peeled it off, you know, $100. 10 $100 bills. And he looked at me and closed one eye and said, spend it. Now, I tell you, I did not believe in God. I didn't answer my prayer on this one. And he turned out to be the head of the mafia of the Boston family. And we talk about the insanity of the disease, and I'm at that stage where, you know, the more excitement I had, you know, that just never was going to be enough. And now I've got, I'm having a little affair with the head of the mafia, and I'm riding in limousines, bodyguards, and the madness began. We go to New York just for a drink. I remember when the famous nightclub in New York was called Birdman opened, and we all, a convoy of all the mobsters and all the end people, you know, we went over there to the opening of Billy Eckstein. I remember in that club and going back to Boston that morning, on Sunday morning, and sitting in the back of that car, you know, just dying inside. You know, and looking out the window on a Sunday morning when young people were about to cross the street with their little kids going to church, and I made a commitment sitting on a segregated train, and I never put my foot in the church again, because there was no God, and it was the whole thing, and I was looking out the window, and it was like a voice said to me, "Clara, something's wrong with your life," and I agreed. The problem was Boston. That's what you need to do, get out of Boston. So he comes off the road, and I tell him about, you know, we need to go to California. His my aunt and uncle were dancers, and they danced. They were teachers at the MGM studios, and they taught all the movie stars, you know, dance routines in those days. And we thought it was a good idea. We pick up this little son. He's 10 years old, and I don't know who he is, because I stopped visiting him because it's too painful to watch him look at me with that look. You know, kids grow up, and when they ask you those questions that, you know, a parent is supposed to be there to answer, like, "But Mom, you promised me last time you came, you know, you were going to take me to the park. You see, but I'm too busy." So I pat him on the head, and I send him to a better camp next year, and I buy him more toys and more expensive clothes. You see, but I got to get back downtown, you know, and crawl up on the stool with all the other geniuses that are sitting in those clubs, you know, solving the problems of the world. But, you know, we pick him up and we put him in the back of that car. We go straight out Route 66, right in L.A. And I went with good intentions. You see, I'm one of the ones with good intentions that, but I take a drink. And then the drink would take me. And then I give it the power, because I couldn't stop drinking. So I went with good intentions. I was going to be like those other ladies. That I'd grown up in the most wonderful family, and I knew what ladies were about because I grew up in that kind of environment and our lifestyle and when I lived in Atlanta. You see, but I'm an alcoholic, and the first thing I did when we got in L.A. was call up on the first jazz club, go to the first jazz club and call up on the stool. You know, and it was good, and it worked out all right for a while, and he got a job, and then I, by a fluke, went into a little small business, just by a fluke, and it started to do well, and I wasn't drinking quite as much, but all the time, it started getting worse again, and after a few years of that, you know, we had two more children in L.A., another son and my younger daughter. And then it came that time, you know, about 10 years later, where I had really crossed what they call the invisible line. I had long crossed it, but I kept trying to make it work. You know, once you cross that line, you just can't. It's never going to work again. So I went and started doing those things in total blackouts, and I started ending up in strange places in L.A. And my sisters and brothers, who'd been very successful in their careers, all moved to the West Coast. They came to visit. They loved it. And so they got established, and they started to look at me. And it's something about people who love you, and when they look at you with that look. And I could see their pain, and they'd say to me, "But you're drinking too much. Why aren't you taking care of your kids? And why are you doing this? Why aren't you doing that?" And you know, get off my back. You know, I know what I'm doing. Because when I want to stop drinking, I'll stop. That was always my song. I'll stop when I want to. Yeah, but I'm not ready yet. And I don't know what, I wasn't ready for the morning when it came. But you know, by that time, alcohol had taken me to a place where there was absolutely no return. When I started getting into violent behavior and those blackouts out there, one of my sisters was a nurse at Cedar Sinai in Beverly Hills at the hospital. And I was beginning to lose it all. I never thought I'd stand at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, "Thank you, God. You took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed." Came that time in my life when I needed to stop drinking, and I needed to stop dying, and I needed a God of my understanding in my life that would change it. And I went there to her to save me one more time. The husband and I, we've been married 25 years by now. We both are in bad shape from the alcohol, and I'm not taking his inventory. This is my story. And it was all falling apart. And I said to her, but save me one more time. I just need two more payments, you know, to save the house. And she said, it pains us to watch you live the way you live. And it's going to pain us even more to watch you die. And you know, when the word, you know, dying and death had always been functioned in me, I just functioned out of fear just from the two words from probably when I was 5 years old. And I turned and I walked out of that hospital and I went back to that house, and standing outside was this guy with a green uniform on, and he's a marshal. He's putting a lock on the door, and the husband's gone, and he had made his exit by saying, you know, either I'm going to kill you or you're going to kill me, because now we've got weapons we are fighting. And we'd never fought in all those years when we were just having it was a rather good marriage in the beginning. And he left. I'm standing outside the house. My little daughter at the time was 8 years old. The next son was maybe about 10. And the one that moved from Boston with us, he was now 19 years old. And he's standing outside and he's looking at me, and a friend had put some money in an envelope, and all my people had walked away. You know, I'm feeling like that ship, you know, where the rats are running and the ship is sinking and I have no place to go. And I'm standing on that sidewalk and I'm looking at those kids, and I'm drinking around the clock by this time. The older son looked at me and he said, you know, I don't know where you're going, but I'm not going with you. He said, I don't even know who you are. And I cannot tell you, because by this time, I'm crying silent tears. Because I can't, there are no tears left. But the arrogance of my alcoholic behavior is said to him, well, screw you too. And he turned and he walked out of my life, and so a friend had put some money in an envelope and left it for me, and I found this envelope, and I had one bag, the other two, and I just stand there with this one little bag. The bank had taken the cars and the trucks and the employees, and I came in here owing thousands of dollars in internal revenue and payroll taxes, and it was all gone. And I called a cab, and the cab driver came, and I handed him this note with this envelope with the note on it. It was an address. And he said, lady, he said, this is the ghetto, South Central Los Angeles. You want me to take you there? I said, whatever it says. We get in this cab. And I ended up in South Central Los Angeles in the ghetto. I shall never forget walking up those steps and opening that door and going inside. I drew the drapes. And I am sure I was doomed to die of this disease. My two kids would never live like this in their lives, and they're looking at me. And I drew the drapes, and so I got comfortable. I went out and bought myself a white terrycloth robe to drink in, and a bright red wig that had bangs. And I used to get drunk and trim the bangs. Now I'm in total black house all the time. I'm living off food stamps. I'm drinking, you know, Ripple wine. I had a choice, Thunderbird or Ripple. And I used to walk in, you know, it was in the ghetto, about six liquor stores in the radius of two blocks. And, you know, I'd walk in there because I didn't want these guys to know that I was drinking all that wine. So I'd just switch around. And one smart ass, he said to me, he'd say to me, what's it going to be? Thunderbird, you know, what's the word? Thunderbird. And so I know having a choice. Do I have red Thunderbird today or white Thunderbird? Who cares? You know, it's all 49 cents. And I don't know how many of you ladies love bars, but I loved bars. And I'd come out of these blackouts about 10, 11 o'clock at night. And I could hear my heart just pounding. And sometimes my heart would beat so rapidly that it would feel as if it was going to explode with just the pain. It was all about fear. And the kids, by this time, the grandparents had moved out to L.A. from Boston and had gotten the house and taken the two kids so they wouldn't have to live like that. And I would have to get out of that chair and get over to the nearest sleazy bar. I just loved those bars. You know, I always loved that at the end stool, that way you could just sit and look right at that mirror. You know, and probably feeling like that song about Eleanor Rigby, you know, wonder where all those other lonely people were coming from. And there I was, and listening to you. I don't know about you ladies, but I met a lot of out-of-work commercial airline pilots. Every once in a while, I'd run into a neurosurgeon sitting on those stools. And we drank out of the barrel, you know. The no label, the wine didn't have any particular labels on it, you know. Whatever came out of that barrel, you know, you could buy, and the glass is 39 cents a glass. And I should never forget one guy. I want to talk about him for a second. He's sitting there. He was really attractive on my left. He kind of looked like the Denzel Washington type. And he looked at me, and I had paid my 39 cents for my wine. And he's sitting there with an empty glass. He turned to me and he introduced himself. And he said, I'm a retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Air Force. I was really impressed because he was about 24 years old. He's already retired. And he said, yeah, baby, he said. He said, actually, I'm a U-2 pilot. He said, what I do, he said, can I have a sip of your wine? I said, yeah, I have some, you know. And he said, what I do is I fly secret missions all over the world. He said, last night I flew over Russia. So I took a sip of my wine and I said, I know you did, darling, because I was on that trip with you last night. So those are the kind of relationships I'm getting off those stools. You know, there's a paragraph in the book, Big Book and a Vision for Youth that said some of us sought at places looking for understanding, companionship, and approval. And I'm out there looking for love in the wrong places with the wrong type of people. I end up in the middle of at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning after the bars are closed, and I'd probably been dumped off of there in blackout. Come to that awful hour in the morning, 3 and 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, in a fetal position in tall, wet grass, and watching dogs traveling in the ghetto. You know, they just travel in packs. And in those days, there was metal trash cans out on the sidewalk. And they're all looking for food. When you live in those kind of conditions, it's all about survival. And I'm down there in that grass, you know, praying to the God I don't believe in, you know, if you just get me out of this one. And listening to those dogs shove the can out into the street and the lid begin to roll. And the silence, it sounded, I could hear my heart pounding. And the earth seemed like quiet and there was nobody out there but me. And the picture of my little daughter, who's now about 10 years old, I've been down there for about 2 years. And you know, it would come into my consciousness, and I could still see her saying to me, but Mom, you promised me you were going to take me to come to the PTA meeting. But you never come because you get drunk. I cannot tell you how that pained me. And I'd always make the promise, but baby, next time, just let me know. And I really wanted to do that, but I always had to take a drink to get myself together to get there, but I could never get there. But I get up off that ground and get up those steps, charge down that hall, get to the bathroom, you know, and you know, pass on my knees on that, right before that toilet, cold porcelain sliding around, you know, it's so cold, it seems that that hour in the morning. I don't know if you've ever passed out, you know, in a room where the room is spinning, And here I am sitting there on the floor, you know, head leaning on that cold porcelain, you know, and the two words that always greeted me was American Standard. And I had to get up off that floor and make the run. Same old story over and over again. And I don't know, I went on one of my last runs, and it was another. I'm still trying to be a party girl. I've got wine sores on my face now. You know, I've got fluid on my ankles and on my knees and my joints. I can hardly walk. And I'm wearing moo-moo things because I'm just bloated. I'm dying, don't know it, in denial. One more Sunday morning, it seems that the God that I've come to believe in would try to get my attention. It always seemed like it was on Sunday morning. And one Sunday morning, right out where the Lakers used to play at the Forum, Crenshaw and Perry Avenue, on a Sunday morning, they didn't have cell phones in those days. And I came to, when I came to, I was in a Catholic hospital in Inglewood, California, which is right outside the ghetto. Somebody must have called them, because I remembered, my last remembrance of being in there was some guy with a, I remember the night before in a bar, some guy with a cowboy boot on, that's all I remembered was a leg. And my head was against the curbstone and I was lying in the gutter. And this guy was kicking me in the head. And he was kicking in my ribs one at a time. See, I know about pain, that pain has no memory. You know, it's so beautifully described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous as the jaywalker. I kept doing insane things with my insane friends and always expected different results. And there I was one more time, and this guy's almost killing me. The next time I came to, I was in the hospital. Paramedics working on me, putting the tubes in, police at the foot of the bed. And there was an older nun with a black habit on, and she had on horn-rimmed glasses. She had her hands in the sleeves, and she's leaning over me, and she's trying to get me to talk to the police, and I don't want to talk. They left. And when I refused to talk to the police, the older nun turned around, and she walked quickly to the door, and she stood, and she turned back, and she looked at me. It was something about, we talk about a moment of clarity. And she looked at me, and she shook her head sadly, and she left. But the young nun stood there, probably in her early 20s, had on a white habit, and all I could see was this part of her face. And her eyes were as blue as the heavens. And she leaned over me, and she had some solution and some gauze, and she was wiping the blood out of the corner of both my eyes. I had a brain concussion, and she leaned over me, and she said, "How did you ever let your life get into such a state?" And never occurred to me that alcohol had any. I thought maybe a little, but that isn't it. It's people, places, and things. They just get off my back. They kept me for 3 days, and that young nun was assigned to dress me. And I shall never forget that morning, because that's how they treated alcoholics in those days. For the ribs, they put gauze around me, and then the interns from the USC would walk around us with a 2.5-inch white tape. It pulled the ribs back in place, which meant you bent over. And I remember her putting my jacket over my shoulder. You should have seen it trying to find out, putting that red wig back on. And she couldn't find out where the bangs went. And she kept twisting it, you know. And finally, you know, she just looked at me and she walked me to the front of that front door of that hospital. And she put her arms around me, the spiritual being she is. And I've never seen her in, but I call her my earth angel. Because she put her arms around me gently and she said, "Try not to drink today." And I'm an alcoholic because I shuffled off to the first liquor store. And I bought some wine. It was 3 weeks later on April the 9th, 1974, I came out of the blackout. On the floor in a dirty room, and I don't know what happened. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I believe it was a spiritual, it was a divine intervention that the Spirit of God must have kissed me gently and said, "Child, get off the floor. You don't ever have to live like an animal again." And I remember standing in that dark room in the stench of stale wine and a dirty, unkempt body, you know, because I had lost the will to care. And I'm standing in that room and I'm crying and I'm asking for help. A simple prayer, you know, just God help me. And somehow I went to the phone and I called my last friend who had given me the envelope. We've been friends. We still are friends, 40-some years now. I called and I said, "Rachel," I said, "I think I'm going to die if I don't stop drinking." And the truth was finally out. That's what I've learned about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the traditions of this program, you know. It's the truth that will set you free. So I finally admitted, because somewhere in the back of my head, I knew that alcohol had some, but I was terrified to think that I had to stop drinking. I didn't know how to live without drinking, because drinking was a way of life for me for over 25 years. She said, "There's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous." She said, "Why don't you call them?" And I go to the phone, I pick up the phone, and I said, I asked the operator, I said, "Is there a place called Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she said, "Yes, there is." She said, I'll put you right through to them, dear." And she was probably an alcoholic recovering, you know. She said, "I'll put you right, it's called Central Office." How would she know? So she said, "I'll put you right through to them." And she did. And a man said, "Good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Jim." He said, "How can I help you?" And I said, "Man, in my best street language, I said, man, my name is Clara and I can't stop drinking." He said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, dear." And he started telling me how he to go to meetings and how to go to a meeting and what they would do. They'd greet me. I just told you my story. I got him on the phone and I said to him, I say, "Do you have meetings in Beverly Hills?" He said, "Yes, we do." He said, "But you're going to meet in your neighborhood." I said, "Okay, I can do that." So I went to my first meeting that night, and I remember sitting in the first row on the end chair. And they started the meeting, and they asked for the hands of a newcomer, and I didn't know what that was. So, and the lady behind me touched me on the shoulder, and she said, "You're a newcomer, honey. Raise your hands." And at the coffee break, she gave me her name on a little piece of paper. Her name is Carol, and she's still my sponsor tonight. 31 years. We got into this incredible journey, and it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink from that moment. And God willing, it will never happen a day at a time. We got into the steps, and we got into the in making them. You know, I got into the fourth step, and I did that inventory, and I put the names of my kids and my family right on the top of that list. And then I'll tell you a little about what happened to them. I lived there for the next 6 months because I wasn't employable, and I was so physically sick from the alcohol. My body was just a mess, and so when I was 6 months sober, my sponsor made. I got a job as my first job was as a waitress. I was a terrible waitress. Oh man, I had and complained about getting tips and never getting tips because I had a bad attitude. You know, I spilled a lot of coffee on a lot of people. Did not apologize. You know, so anyway. It got better. When I was 3 years sober, I went back into that company that drank away, and that's what I do today. I have I don't call it successful, but I do very well. And what I do is I have a 5-star management company to the homes of the movie stars, the rich and the famous. And what I do is property management. I manage their homes and the concierge service. It's a great place. And I just absolutely love it. And I have, you know, a lot of people working, and it's just great to be out in the world and enjoying your life and doing what you do. I started when I got to those amend steps, that older son who stood in front of that house and said, "I don't know who you are." walked out of my life, and it was about 4 years before I saw him again. He'd gone on to into the movie industry and in acting, and he did very well. And traveling, and he had also been trained under the aunt and uncle in their studios, and he was doing very well. And in the late 80s, he was working for ABC Television. He was a unit manager for the 6 o'clock news anchors, and it was at a time when the Studio 54. I'm so sure some of you have heard Studio 54. But I had, and thank God for these steps, because I had made my peace with him. We had had the long talks, and we had cleared up the wreckage of the past. I remember how painful it was, you know, to be honest with my children and tell them and admit my share of the fourth column or the fourth step, you know, and took responsibility for the fact that I explained to them, as my sponsor said, that I was a sick person, not a bad person. And you know, and that older son said to me, "No, Mom, listen, you know, that was yesterday. We don't have tomorrow. We just have today." And he was just a wonderful young man. And when he got involved in the after stuff, and he was in celebrity world, now he's doing drugs. You know, he's shooting drugs in that place. When his contract was over at ABC, he came back to Los Angeles and got married, had a little son. This is in the 80s, late 80s. And he called me one day from San Francisco. He was teaching at the junior college level of theater arts. And he called me and said, "Mommy, I don't feel great. And I went to the doctor today, and they told me I've got something called HIV. And, you know, in those days, it was... you know, that was a death sentence. I didn't know what it meant either. So I'm very active in the program, and I bring you greetings to my home group. And I just took off and went to San Francisco and walked around San Francisco with that son. And I went to the doctor, and they said, "Well, we don't have medication or anything for you." But he said, "Well, Mom, you know, I'll just stay here and work, and when I feel like I can't work, I'll call you." And came 19 months later, that call from San Francisco, "Mom, I'm too sick to take care of myself, and I don't know what to do." And I said, "You come home," because now I had a home for him. You know, I can remember when I couldn't take him to the park, but I had a place for him. But the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that's where I was in his life at that time. And he came home, and you know, and he'd done a lot of work for the Grateful Dead. And almost a year later, I saw him go from a handsome, you know, 175-pound young man, you know, to 99 pounds. And my sponsees and my sponsor, and a lot of the old timers, were there for me. I'm looking at Ruby. They were there for me when that was going on in my at that time. And then, you know, it was that Saturday morning at 10:15, rasping sound of death. And never occurred to me that alcohol had any. I thought maybe a little, but that isn't it. It's people, places, and things. They just get off my back. They kept me for 3 days, and that young nun was assigned to dress me. And I shall never forget that morning, because that's how they treated alcoholics in those days. For the ribs, they put gauze around me, and then the interns from the USC would walk around us with a 2.5-inch white tape. They pulled the ribs back in place, which meant you bent over. And I remember her putting my jacket over my shoulder. You should have seen it trying to find out, putting that red wig back on. And she couldn't find out where the bangs went. And she kept twisting it, you know. And finally, you know, she just looked at me, and she walked me to the front of that front door of that hospital. And she put her arms around me, the spiritual being she is. And I've never seen her in, but I call her my earth angel. because she put her arms around me gently and she said, "Try not to drink today." And I'm an alcoholic because I shuffled off to the first liquor store and I bought some wine. It was 3 weeks later on April 9th, 1974, I came out of the blackout on the floor in a dirty room, and I don't know what happened. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I believe it was a spiritual, it was a divine intervention, that the Spirit of God must have kissed me gently and said, "Child, get off the floor. You don't ever have to live like an animal again." And I remember standing in that dark room in the stench of stale wine and a dirty, unkept body, you know, because I had lost the will to care. And I'm standing in that room and I'm crying and I'm asking for help. A simple prayer, you know, just, "God, help me." And somehow I went to the phone and I called my last friend who had given me the envelope. We've been friends. We still are friends, 40-some years now. I called and I said, "Rachel," I said, "I think I'm going to die if I don't stop drinking." And the truth was finally out. That's what I've learned about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the traditions of this program, you know. It's the truth that will set you free. But I finally admitted, because somewhere in the back of my head, I knew that alcohol had some, but I was terrified to think that I had to stop drinking. I didn't know how to live without drinking, because drinking was a way of life for me for over 25 years. She said, "There's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous." She said, "Why don't you call them?" And I go to the phone, I pick up the phone, and I said, I asked the operator, I said, "Is there a place called Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she said, "Yes, there is." She said, I'll put you right through to them, dear." And she was probably an alcoholic recovering, you know. She said, "I'll put you right, it's called Central Office." How would she know? So she said, "I'll put you right through to them," and she did. And a man said, "Good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Jim." He said, "How can I help you?" And I said, "Man," in my best street language, I said, "Man, my name is Clara and I can't stop drinking." He said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, dear." And he started telling me how he to go to meetings and how to go to a meeting and what they would do. They'd greet me. I just told you my story. I got him on the phone and I say to him, I say, "Do you have meetings in Beverly Hills?" He said, "Yes, we do." He said, "But you're going to meet in your neighborhood." I said, "Okay, I can do that." So I went to my first meeting that night, and I remember sitting in the first row on the end chair. And they started the meeting, and they asked for the hands of a newcomer, and I didn't know what that was. And the lady behind me touched me on the shoulder, and she said, "You're a newcomer, honey. Raise your hands." And at the coffee break, she gave me her name on a little piece of paper. Her name is Carol, and she's still my sponsor tonight. 31 years. We got into this incredible journey, and it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink from that moment. And God willing, it will never happen a day at a time. We got into the steps, and we got into the I got into the fourth step, and I did that inventory, and I put the names of my kids and my family right on the top of that list, and I'll tell you a little about what happened to them. I lived there for the next 6 months because I wasn't employable, and I was so physically sick from the alcohol. My body was just a mess, and so when I was 6 months sober, my sponsor my first job was as a waitress. I was a terrible waitress. Oh man, I had and complained about getting tips and never getting tips because I had a bad attitude. You know, I spilled a lot of coffee on a lot of people. Did not apologize, you know. So anyway, it got better. When I was 3 years sober, I went back into that company that drank away, and that's what I do today. I don't call it successful, but I do very well. And what I do is I have a 5-star management company to the homes of the movie stars, the rich and the famous. And what I do is property management. I manage their homes and the concierge service. And it's a great place. And I just absolutely love it. And I have a lot of people working. And it's just great to be out in the world and enjoying your life and doing what you do. I started when I got to those amend steps, that older son who stood in front of that house and said, "I don't know who you are," walked out of my life, and it was about 4 years before I saw him again. He'd gone on into the movie industry and acting, and he did very well. Traveling, and he had also been trained under the aunt and uncle in their studios, and he was doing very well. And in the late 80s, he was working for ABC Television. He was a unit manager for the 6 o'clock news anchors, and it was at a time when the Studio 54. I'm so sure some of you have heard Studio 54, and thank God for these steps, because I had made my peace with him. We had had the long talks, and we had cleared up the wreckage of the past. I remember how painful it was, to be honest with my children and tell them and admit my share of the fourth column or the fourth step, and took responsibility for the fact that I explained to them, as my sponsor said, that I was a sick person, not a bad person. And that older son said to me, "Mom, listen, that was yesterday. We don't have tomorrow. We just have today." And he was just a wonderful young man. And when he got involved in the after stuff, and he was in celebrity world, now he's doing drugs. He's shooting drugs in that place. When his contract was over at ABC, he came back to Los Angeles and got married, had a little son. This is in the 80s, late 80s. And he called me one day from San Francisco. He was teaching at the junior college level of theater arts. And he called me and said, "Mommy, I don't feel great." And I went to the doctor today, and they told me I've got something called HIV. And in those days, it was... that was a death sentence. I didn't know what it meant either. So I'm very active in the program, and I bring you greetings to my home group. And I just took off and went to San Francisco and walked around San Francisco with that son. And I went to the doctor, and they said, "Well, we don't have medication or anything for you." But he said, "Well, Mom, I'll just stay here and work, and when I feel like I can't work, I'll call you." Came 19 months later, that call from San Francisco, "Mom, I'm too sick to take care of myself, and I don't know what to do." And I said, "You come home," because now I had a home for him. I can remember when I couldn't take him to the park, but I had a place for him. But the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's where I was in his life at that time. And he came home, and he'd done a lot of work for the Grateful Dead. Almost a year later, I saw him go from a handsome, 175-pound young man, to 99 pounds. And my sponsees and my sponsor, and a lot of the old timers, were there for me. I'm looking at Ruby. They were there for me when that was going on at that time. And then, it was that Saturday morning at 10:15, rasping sound of death. He was quiet. He was gone. And I prayed this soul rode the wings of angels, and I made my peace. And if you haven't, I tell you to do those steps, because life is brief. And it's very fragile. And we don't have tomorrow to do it. We've got to do it today. The next son, alcohol and drugs. I'm a double winner. I'm a member of Al-Anon. Had to put him out of the house when he was 17, 18 years old. It was too painful. You know, I do a program where I take directions and I follow them. That wasn't always easy for me. And he's been in and out. He's now, you know, 47 years old, and he's got 4 years again. And this time he did what they said, do. Get a sponsor, go to meetings, be involved, you know, and work a program. And that's what he's doing. It took him years to get there. But whatever time it takes, you know, it's what it takes. It's all in God's time. You know, I always have that little saying about, you know, you can't see till you can see, you can't hear till you can hear. That daughter, I saw her, that I could never get to her PTA meeting. You know, when I was 5 years sober, the promises started coming true for me. And it says in the promises, all these extravagant promises we think not. I saw her go into the Ice Capades as the first black professional ice skater with the Dr. Hamill tour. The grandparents had sent her in and her for that training. And I got to tell you, you know, it all comes together. And you know, and being active in the program is my life today. No matter what happens, when I'm called to do anything or participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll do it. And I just want to share with you before I sit down, one of the 12-step call. In those days, we did a lot of them. We don't have the opportunity. We don't do as many as we did years ago, because they have treatment centers and they didn't have any of that when I got sober 31 years ago. And I'm happy for those who are, all of you who are now, who have that experience and that's available to you. But I want to talk about getting too busy. When I was 4 years sober and I'd gone back into my business and now I bought myself a house. In the book, you know, when we get sober, you know, the problem centers in the mind, and that's where I had to be so careful. I'm dancing around on a Saturday afternoon. I'm four and a half years sober now, and I'm dancing around with a broom in the living room on a Saturday afternoon, listening to some Billie Holiday records, remembering the good old days. It's so easy to forget. I get a phone call from central office. And I am annoyed. I pick up the phone, and I just got to share this story. I said, hello, and the lady from central office said, is this Clara? And I said, yes. She said, we have a 12-step call from Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles, and you're in District 57. Would you please take the call? I said to her, you know, I don't think I'm qualified. I said, you know, there are a lot of old-timers in the Los Angeles area that would be far more experienced to go down to Skid Row. I've been living over in the ghetto for a long time, you know, but Skid Row was something different. And and she's listening to me. She said, oh, stop it. Yeah, she pulled my coat. And I always heard you never go on a 12-step call alone. So I said, well, I better pick up the phone. I call my sponsor to see if she'd get me out of this. So I call my sponsor, and I said, Carol, and I told her what I just told you. And I said, you know, and she wasn't saying a word. So I said to her, what do you think? And she said, I don't think. Just do it. She hung up. So I thought, oh my. So I get on the phone. I'm sponsoring this little Hollywood actress. She's got 90 days. So I figured I'd get her. So I get her on the phone. I said, Constance, I said, I'm going on a 12-step call. She said, where? I said, it's down on Skid Row. She said, I don't want to do that. I said, I don't care what you don't want to do. You get over here. So we get in my big Cadillac, we wheel downtown, and this is a 12-step call that rocketed my program into a fourth dimension, just like the book promises. we find this place, the lady in the central office had said, well, you know, there's no marquee out there, it's just got a number. And so I said, we got the little address, and the lady's name was Dorothy, 20 years old, and she's in this hotel. So we park and we go inside, and inside the lobby was that they had a big boom radio, and this is romance in the ghetto. I mean in the down in this hotel, and they were dancing, and it smelled like a latrine. All these wine bottles were everywhere. Read the arrow along the wall said ring this bell. And I rang the bell. Here comes this little clerk. He said, oh, yeah. And I said, somebody here named Dorothy. He said, she's up on the third floor. Oh, Jesus, he said, she's on the third floor, just like that. So we get on the elevator in downtown L.A. Those elevators are old buildings, and you can see the casing of the wall as it goes up. We go up, the elevator would go up a few feet, and it would stop, and it would drop 2 feet, and 2 inches. And we finally got to the third floor, and we walk over these. Three drunks were in the hall. And we get down, he said, there's no numbers in this hotel. She's at the end of the hall. And I walk, we step over there, we get to the end, knock on the door, and a little boy said, come in. We walk into a little small room, and water bugs were so huge. She was on the floor, and she was turning blue because she was trying to get something out of her throat. And she lost all body control. It was filthy and stench, it was unbelievable. And we didn't know what, we looked at each other and we didn't know what to do, but we just used our own common sense. We stretched her out, we kept pumping whatever it was pumped out of her mouth. Because as we walked in that room, she was probably gagging to death. And my whole perception changed. And it was like I was on a mission and I was in the right place at the right time, as we say. And we picked up off the floor and we dressed her. We never said another word between us. We got her downstairs and I called central office. I called central office. What do we do with her? She was blonde. She was so pretty and she was just a mess and just awful. And we took her into this place and we got her signed up and they told us where to take her. It isn't there. It's a parking lot now. And I remember sitting across from her in a diner trying to get her sober before we could get her registered. We're sitting there in that morning, and this is when this all started. This incredible journey really started for me. And I started talking about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first step. You know, we're powerless over alcohol in the second half, and our lives are unmanageable. Talked about the second step, and she could relate to that, too. About God restoring us to sanity. She talked about the insanity in her family and that they're all dying, you know, of alcohol or drug addiction. And we got to the third step and I started talking about God. And she stood up and she said, don't you talk to me about God. And I don't know, I lost it. You know, I'm just, you know, I reach across and I grab her by the little pink sweater we put on her. I pull her forward. I'm going to punch her lights out. The 12 steps say having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the step, we carry the message. We don't beat them up if they don't want it. And I started going down there every night, you know, for my business. Into that facility where Dorothy was. And when I went down on the 15th day, she'd gotten well and she was gone. But Dorothy, I hope wherever she is tonight, I hope she's sober. And she will never know how her life touched mine and how God touched me and Alcoholics Anonymous and what it means to me. It means my life. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've been here for 6 months. I'm sober, but I'm broken, I'm bored, what do I do? Someone like Milton will get up and say, get a job, break! And you go out there and you try a little of this, try a little of that. I've got to remember that I'm bodily, mentally different from my fellows in my relationship to alcohol. And I've got to remember that I'm bodily, mentally similar to you in my relationship to alcohol. See, what that means to me is I can be very similar to other people out there in the world. My brother, example, now that I'm sober, my brother and I are very much alike. If there's ever two men in the world that look alike, we look alike. We're related by blood. We both love golf. We think the same way politically. We're raised in the same home. In many, many ways, we are as much alike as two men can be. We're only 2 years apart. We're very much alike. But he does really weird stuff with alcohol. Just bizarre. Absolutely. But we go golfing, and on the third hole, he'll order a beer. He may or may not drink it. It's just he has a bizarre relationship to alcohol. It means nothing to him. Alcohol means nothing. I am bodily and mentally different from him in my relationship to alcohol, and I got to remember that. And in here, I may be very, very different than you in many, many different ways. And this was important for me to understand in order to identify in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the facts of your life could be very, very different. I guarantee you that the majority of people in this room were not raised by a Lutheran minister and his wife in Seattle, drug dealer.